Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with stars, creators, and industry leaders on Broadway, off-Broadway, and beyond. I'm Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to James Imes. He's a writer and director who was recently awarded the 2021 Pulitzer Prize for Drama for Fat Ham, his comic, modern-day retelling of Hamlet, set at a backyard barbecue thrown by a black family in the South. The show premiered in the spring of last year in a digital production from the Wilma Theater in Philadelphia, and now audiences are getting the chance to see it on stage for the first time in a live, in-person co-production from the Public Theater and the National Black Theater. In addition to his writing, including plays like TJ Loves Sally Forever and Kill Move Paradise, and his directing activities, he's also a co-artistic director of the Wilma. Now he's in the virtual studio with me to talk Queering Hamlet, decentralizing artistic leadership, and his secret to writing prolifically. Hey, James. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. First of all, it's been a couple months, but congratulations on the Pulitzer. How's it feel?
Thank you. It still feels a bit surreal, but I don't know. It's really lovely. I'm still sort of basking in the honor of it, but also just like the warm, fuzzy feelings it gives you about your work when, you know, your contemporaries sort of say, we like what you're doing. That always feels really good.
That was actually my next question, is how an award like this makes you think differently about, or does it make you think differently about your work and yourself as an artist?
Yeah, it does in a couple of ways. I mean, I think the biggest way is that I feel like I want to take more risk. I want to be more adventurous. It's made me braver. But I also feel like it sort of pulls me into a community of people that I have admired for a really long time. So that's amazing to sort of look at that list of folks and, you know, people I've read and studied and acted in their work over my career, then to have the opportunity to sort of be in the same category with them is really lovely. So those two things in particular, I carry with me sort of like daily as I'm working and continuing to write. I think about those things a lot.
Yeah. Do you have a sense yet of what kind of doors it is opening for you that might not otherwise have opened?
No, I don't think so yet. I think because of when it happened and like where, you know, season planning and things like that go. So, you know, I think most decisions had been made about what things were going to be moving forward by the time the news came out. So that's, you know, that's the thing that I think remains to be seen a bit for me, is like what is the outcome, or what is it affect? I imagine it will affect it pretty concretely eventually. And I've felt like ripples of things where I'm like, oh, that feels new.
Yeah. And so let's talk about the work that's happening right now, Fat Ham at the Public. First of all, take us back to when you first wrote the play. What was the inspiration and what prompted it at that particular time in your life?
Well, I've always really had an affinity for Hamlet as a character. Not necessarily because, you know, most of my training in my career has been as an actor. So it wasn't so much about wanting to be Hamlet. I'm much more of a Horatio.
Have you ever played Hamlet or been in Hamlet?
I've been in an abbreviated version of Hamlet in college, which is where it started for me. That was when the first time I read the play, and it stayed with me from then.
And were you Horatio in that?
No,
in that
I was Hamlet in that.
But you were Hamlet. Okay.
But I wasn't very good. I am not a Hamlet. I am Horatio and Benvolio, and I'm very reasonable and level-headed and try to get people to do the right thing.
It often ends badly for you. Yeah.
Or you're the only one that survives. I think that's
exactly. Yeah.
But I just had been meditating on the play for a while, and I knew that I wanted to sort of work on these three plays that would examine three different Shakespeare characters through a contemporary lens, through a queer lens, and through a lens that would allow me to look at these characters as Black people, essentially. So Hamlet was first, and then I'm sort of in the early process of working on an adaptation of Othello, and then I want to do Antony and Cleopatra. But Hamlet has been sort of like buzzing around in my head for a while, and then I started reading it and thinking about it a lot, and just sat down to start writing. And one of the first things that I wrote was this lovely scene between my Hamlet, whose name is Juicy, and my Laertes, whose name is Larry. And it's one of the first things I wrote, and that scene has stayed in every draft. It's like the kernel of the play that sort of the rest of the play sort of spirals out from, is this quest to be, softer, more tender, more loving, but also more honest and more brave. And also like asking for what you need, which are all of these things that as an adult, I've discovered, oh, I can do these things. Not, so that's kind of how the play started for me.
Why do you feel like all those things that you were just talking about are a fit for Hamlet? Why were those things sort of inherent in your version of Hamlet specifically?
I just kept thinking about, like, if Hamlet were to go better, like let's say if Hamlet wasn't a comedy, what
Yeah,
would be
your
the
version is
things?
very explicitly a comedy, right?
It's
Like
very much a comedy. I mean, even on the Shakespearean level, there's a bit of like, oh, there's a bit of coupling at the end. Like it's very much following the Shakespearean comedy sort of playbook. I think I was asking myself what would be required to sort of make that shift in the story. And I was like, well, if Juicy told people how he felt truly, or if Hamlet did, and if Gertrude, who is my Teedra, said I'm sorry, and also told her son what she needed, that would be an easier story to tell. That would be a funnier story. That would be a less deadly story. And so I started to play with, what happens if these people start, questioning the things that are expected of them. Like, when the ghost shows up, the expectation is that he's going to go through with it. And he goes through with a lot of, attempts at trying to like do the thing that the original ask of Hamlet. And he's not good at it. He also discovers that like he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to harm people. He doesn't want to attack people, but he also discovers in the course of the play that he's absolutely capable of those things. And so he has to deal with those realities too. I feel like that's the only real tragedy in the play is this moment where he outs Larry, which is brutal. It's a catastrophe in a real way. And so if you think about Hamlet in that context, then it is a play about how do you become more vulnerable? How do you become more porous, really? I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways of talking about being tender or being vulnerable or being a soft person. Some of that is just being a little porous so that people can get in and like a lot of who you are at your truest can sort of seep out into the world and other people can have access to it. And I think that's what all the characters ultimately sort of find themselves choosing in the end of my play.
As you were writing, did you go in thinking, oh, I'm definitely going to keep this from Hamlet, but you ended up leaving it behind? Or vice versa, where you thought, oh, I'm definitely not, this isn't going to get in there from Hamlet, but then it ended up working out.
Well, I knew the cast of characters was going to be much smaller. So I knew I wasn't going to have Rosencrantz and Fortinbras. I wasn't going to have all of that. I knew I was going to keep the world kind of tight. There were a few speeches that I desperately wanted to sort of, transconfigurate into my play. So like a few of them are still there. What a piece of work is man, being the most sort of pristine piece of text that is lifted from Shakespeare and put into my play. Also just sort of like Hamlet's, inability to sort of land in a way. A lot of people say that Hamlet is not an active character, but I feel like he's constantly thinking and doing things, not in the traditional heroic sense. And that's why people read him as sort of like stuck. And I think Juicy does a similar set of things where he's like committed to this idea of human resources, which is lovely and wonderful. And I have family members that work in human resources. But it's also a job that's like about keeping other people safe. At its core, it's about care, which is different from what the world is asking of him. So I wanted to maintain that sort of ambivalence. You know, I knew that I wanted Polonius to not be another man at the table, that I wanted another woman in the show. So I made that switch to make the Polonius character a mother instead of a father. And I think that changes how, and then I let that sort of, that matriarch shape control and really, really shift how that character from Hamlet interacts with the two children. And it's different from Polonius. Like, I don't know, she's tough, but she's also like doting in this way that Polonius isn't. What else would I say? Yeah, the players become charades. So like I found ways to sort of take a concept from the play and make it make sense at a barbecue, and charades was automatically a great way to do that. Right. Another thing that I shifted from the original is that a lot of like the Hamlet, the Ophelia mad scene stuff is given to Hamlet. Like that, hey, nani, nani, and sort of like, flipping out is not attributed to this like damsel in distress, but it's attributed to the hero of the play. And then he moves through it. And then we see this really tender moment with his mother of her actual fear of his well-being. That's sort of a tight, tidy list of the stuff that sort of changed and stayed.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the speeches that you wanted to keep, which you kept in varying versions. You do something really interesting in the play with soliloquies and direct address and how much those moments are revealing and how much you can have privacy while you are speaking directly to an audience. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about sort of how the soliloquies work for you in this play.
What I love about the soliloquies is that they instantly activate the audience. So the speaker needs you to work through this concept, through this idea. Mm. And I think at their best, they elicit a sort of like churchness when they're performed. Now, I think we don't feel that when we do, Hamlet or any of the tragedies now, because there's a sort of veil of reverence over how you're supposed to behave in a Shakespeare play. But I think in Shakespeare's time, they were like, no, it's a terrible idea. Don't do that. Don't listen. Like they talked back to these plays. I just believe that, like it threw tomatoes at these plays. They didn't like them. So I know for a fact that they absolutely spoke back, or they had like, audible reactions. And so I just like keep that thread. I also have this real feeling that's kind of foundational to most of the things that I write, is that there isn't really a fourth wall. I think it's a concept that's useful if you want to do a kind of thing. But at the end of the day, if a cell phone goes off in the house, you feel the actors tense. It has a direct effect. And so why pretend like what is happening in the dark is obscured and, boring even. I don't think it's boring. I think it's actually really amazing. I was in a production of Brandon Jacobs Jenkins' play, An Octoroon, in Philadelphia, and someone had a terrible medical emergency in the show. And everyone was fine, but it was a real moment. Like an ambulance came, and that was sort of the moment for me doing this play that is all about sort of like disturbing the relationship between the audience and what's happening on stage. And I just sort of like I never put the fourth wall back up in anything I ever wrote. Like I just said, yeah, if someone chooses to look at the audience, that needs to be powerful. And I think it's even more powerful if the whole time we are, as audience members, are aware of the fact that we are watching and that we are known, that the characters know they are being watched. And so that, that puts a different color on what's happening on stage. If the idea is that when the character looks into the audience, it's intentional, and what they're about to say is powerful because they know we're there. So they know we know everything. Right. Like, there's just something really, I think, delicious about that. And it really does change the moment when someone looks into the audience. It's like, that's right, I'm with you. It's not like, oh, I'm shocked that you see me. It's, yeah, I'm ready to say some things back.
Yeah. And at the end of this play, you do something big and bold and exciting at the end of this play that, and we can even say, you know, for people who haven't, for listeners who haven't seen it yet, we can say spoiler warning, but I wonder if you could, and maybe they'll want to fast forward ahead for a minute or two, but I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about why that sequence felt like the way to end this play and what it sort of, why that's the final moment for this story that you are telling, your version of Hamlet.
Yeah. Endings are hard. Ending things is an impossible task. In real life, it's hard. Like, ending a relationship, it's hard. You know, ending a job, that's hard. So ending things is really difficult. So I'll start there. In the script, the stage direction is very simply the space cracks open in a celebration of the queer, the feminine, and the divine. That's it. That's all the script says. And then you get a really brilliant director like Zaheem Ali who sees that and goes, oh, this is how I see those things. This is how I see divine and queer and black and celebration. And he, you know, him with me and the actors all sort of like pull together this idea that the space would literally crack open and something really kind of fabulous sort of like emerges out of that. And I think after, you know, this like terrible moment of like, you know, the patriarchy choking to death essentially on a rib, you know, Juicy right. doing this horrible thing to this beloved friend of his from his youth, I just felt like those are the deaths, right? This play isn't without death. And then out of death, I want to like continue to reiterate like a big part of life is that something will come out of death, you know. When leaves fall on the ground in the fall, that's like death. We're like surrounded by death. We don't think about it that way. Like, oh, the trees are so beautiful. That's so nice. But we're like literally surrounded by things that are kind of dying. And there's a cyclical nature to like death and life. And you know, this ending in the iteration that it's in is a thing that I wrote in the height of the pandemic when I was losing quite a lot of family. And when I say a lot, I mean a lot. The death in my family was staggering during that time. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to make some sense of why that happens, you know, understanding that it is a thing that we all will meet one day, but just I could not get my head around it. And I just needed to, in some way, find a way to talk about death that was life affirming, that I, as the living, as someone who's left behind, what is my responsibility to the dead? What is my responsibility to those who have passed on? And one of those things that I came out of that thinking and that, you know, interior meditation was to live, like, you know, live fully, live truthfully, live boldly. And so that sort of image of like the space cracks open into these things that feel very life-giving to me, you know, my blackness, my queerness, my relationship to the feminine feels very affirming, life-giving to me. So it just made sense that after all of that, this cage that is this play cracks open and something we can't contain that people will hum as they're walking out of the door. That flows out into the street. That's a thing that leaves, that it can't be contained inside of the cage of the play, so it goes somewhere else. And that ultimately is what I'm always trying to do. I'm never completely successful at doing that, but I feel like we created something really beautiful. Saheem and I and the cast created something really beautiful in that final moment.
I'll have more with James right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
And now here's more with the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, James Imes. The very first production of Fat Ham was at the height of lockdown. None of us were in theaters at that point. And so it was a digital streaming production. It was kind of a movie. Tell us about that adjustment. And what did you learn about the play as you thought about it, you know, thinking about it, playing that story to the screen as opposed to live in a room?
Yeah. So I'm a part of an artistic cohort at a theater in Philly called the Wilma Theater. Yeah. And for that season, before any of these things happened, we had planned a season. And one of the plays was Fat Ham, and we had to make a decision when everything shut down. Do we, you know, we had one more show in the season that we were in, that I was directing, that we turned into a radio play. So that was the first step, was like, oh, we can do this as audio. And then the founding artistic director, who was still a part of the cohort at the time, Blanca Ziska, decided to direct Will Arbery's play, Heroes of the Fourth Turning, as a film. And that's kind of where the idea started, and we tested out all of these things. Like, does this work? Can we do this? Can we afford this? And essentially, there are two plays that take place in the backyard of a house. So it was perfect. You know, we shot Heroes in the Poconos just before it got cold. And then we shot Fat Ham in Virginia just as things were warming up. We had to go a little further south in Pennsylvania because it was February. Yeah. And even then, there were a few days where, like, there were some dailies that came in and I was like, I can see their breath. We have to shoot that again. It's like, this is a barbecue. We can't see their breath. So, you know, we learned a lot about, you know, that kind of storytelling. And Morgan Green, who is also a part of the artistic cohort and is a brilliant director, directed that production to great success. I think the thing that I learned about the play was just how tender and moving it was. I think I thought of it as much more of a romp, you know, rip-roaring comedy. But we really teased out the, like, heart stuff in that play during that process. And I think that this production at the Public is stronger as a result of that, because it's got this underpinning of, like, great emotional warmth, you know, inside of this play that is rollicking and wild and the turns are really, really sharp. I think that's the balance of those two things. It's really brought to bear in this production, but we found those, like, tender moments, because that's what film requires, is this close to the face. You can't hide. We learned a lot about that during that process.
Did the experience of making that essentially a film, did that make you interested in exploring other writing for the screen?
It did. And I have been sort of, like, now dabbling in it in a very, you know, early stages way. I mean, I did a little bit of a TV writer's room for a bit and loved that. I thought it was, I enjoy the collaborative process, like, just as a practice in life. I teach collaboration. Like, I literally teach a class called collaborative theater making. just because it's a real value for me and I love it. Like I enjoy it a lot. So writing for TV is very exciting for me. And so I've done a bit of that. And, you know, I'm yeah. open to anything. I just love writing for the dramatic, you know, in the dramatic form. I just think it's makes so much sense. So I just really love that. So I'm interested in every opportunity I can have to do it.
Yeah. The Fat Ham digital version was streaming for a limited time. Is there any thought of at some point making that available either, you know, through the Wilma or through something like Broadway On Demand or Broadway HD or something like that? Is that, will that live on, do you think?
We're thinking about it. We have a couple of like rights issues with it because we're doing it at a time when people were, I probably shouldn't even be talking about this.
But it's the kind of stuff that everyone was dealing with then, right?
Yeah, everybody was dealing with it. But, you know, we're thinking about maybe doing like a, you know, a showing of it at the theater. Mm-hmm. And like people can come and see it like a one night only or a two night only sort of thing. You know, I loved, you know, what we made, but I also want people to like produce the play in their city and then with the people that they know and with the designers that they love and directors that they love. And, you know, that's why I love plays in the regionals, because, you know, anybody can have access to this play and see it. So, I don't want it to be too much in the wind.
Yeah. What was for you was the biggest surprise or maybe the biggest challenge that you weren't expecting in getting the show up live and in person?
Oh gosh. The biggest thing was that, I had to write out scenes to cover some action that needed to take place, like someone changing into a different costume or like those things were really quick in the film version because we could cheat. You know, cut. Okay. We're going to, you know, we need 5 minutes for Juicy to get into his new shoes or whatever. You know, those things had to happen in real time. So I got to write out some parts of the play that in some cases, parts of the play that I cut back for the film. I got to write those out again and sort of like expand some of the characters a little bit. So, you know, the uncle Rev, we get a lot more of like Rev as a person and Rev's effect on Teedra in particular in this production than we do in the film, because I wrote that, you know, a little bit more of their relationship into the play. Or there was there's a couple of moments where there's like some light ad-libbing because we needed to, you know, make some time for people to move about. And then also like the dinner chat sound of like being at a barbecue, that was so much easier in the live because everybody is like hearing it and it's all sort of mixed in with everything else. In the film, that was really difficult to accomplish and was kind of like choreographed in a way. But there was this abandon with it in the live production. And so it's so much more fun and like, I don't know, it's like unexpected. You feel like you don't know what anybody's going to say, even though they know exactly what they're about to say.
Mm. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you are part of an artistic cohort at the Wilma Theater in Philadelphia. And I feel like that is, you kind of share artistic directorship, if I understand this correctly, with two other artists. It feels like part of a trend at theaters around the country to sort of think about decentralizing power structures and kind of spreading out the leadership of an organization. And I wonder how has that worked for you? Do you feel like, tell us the benefits of a structure like this and how you found working in that?
I mean, I think the major benefit is you don't have to think alone. You don't have to dream alone. You know, I think sometimes being an artistic director can be an isolating and alienating role. And in this, I have, you know, this is the end of my lead artistic director year. Right. So
you each took a season. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I had a great deal of support during this year. And then the year before that, like, you know, there were things that happened, like I was saying, with my family and things like that, where I was able to like step away for a pause to like help out with things at home. and never, no one ever felt like, oh, the ball has dropped. There's nobody at the helm. There's always somebody at the helm. And the same will be true with Morgan. So it really does help with that. You know, dreaming together, having a shared idea of what we want the future of the theater to be. You know, our tastes are all very distinct and different, you know, so that's also a thing, like the seasons look, even when, you know, each of us are leading an individual season, all of our sort of like sensibilities are in that decision making. So Morgan's season, I'm like, yeah, that looks like us. You know, it's got a few, you know, a few things that feel very much like, oh, that looks like something James would pick. And then there's things that feel very much like Morgan and things that feel very much like Yuri. So it's just a beautiful sort of mix of people's aesthetics, styles, interest, obsessions, and also just makes the management of the organization less daunting when there's more of you.
Has it brought any particular challenges that maybe you didn't expect going into it that you have had to navigate?
Yeah, decisions take longer. And I think that's okay. I actually think that's, I mean, it's a challenge because sometimes you want to go. You want to like, you know what's next. Mm-hmm. But it does force us to slow down, to consider, to listen. And I think that's a good thing ultimately. You know, we all have very different tastes and points of view. At times that's great. And there are times where it's like, this is okay. We got to work through this. You know, right. There are times when it's a little bit more difficult to sort of truly see each other, but we trust each other. And so even when we don't agree on a thing, I trust that everybody has the best of intention and is trying to do the best for the organization. But those are two real challenges. It's like, how do you, you know, make sure that your voice is heard without taking up too much space? And then how do you like keep the movement of things at a clip that feels urgent, or not even urgent, but just feels like propulsive without sort of skirting over somebody's point of view or leaving somebody out of the decision making? We work really hard to not do that.
Yeah. I feel like one thing that maybe listeners who are first encountering you and your work with Fat Ham might not know about you is that you are extremely prolific. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about, like you look at your body of work and the you know, I'm scrolling on your website and the list keeps going. You've written a ton of plays. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about how you think about being that prolific, and do you consider yourself a particularly disciplined writer, or do you have like a set schedule, or how does the act of writing and the sort of rigorous act of writing fit into you and your life as an artist?
Yeah, that list on the website is slightly deceptive because some of those plays are very old. Like, there's two plays.
But you still wrote them. I mean,
yes. I think for a long time, writing was a kind of meditation. Before I started to really get a lot of productions, it really was a space where I got to like work through and metabolize how I was feeling. And those early plays feel like that. They feel very much like, okay, you have a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
And now I'm not quite as, you know, I'm not quite as fast as I used to be. I'm not quite as quick. Although I still remain like somebody that rewrites and does writing notes relatively quickly. It just feels nice. You know, the act of writing for the stage feels good to me. It is pleasurable for me. And so like with people who like, you know, play pickup basketball games or like read a book in a day or, you know, run, you know, 5 miles every day. It feels very much in line with that kind of pursuit, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly writing. I'm not someone that's like, oh, I write from, you know, 4 to 6 every morning, or I write from like, you know, 8 to like midnight. I'm someone who is like perpetually writing on my phone, writing on my computer, writing in a notebook, pulling those things together into a form, sometimes I'll just hear a line and like put it in the notes and like, well, one day this line will be necessary. So it's a little bit of where my space of competition, like if I'm being really honest, like it is where my ambition lies, is how much story can I put into the world. And some of them, rightfully so, have never seen the light of day, and that's okay, you know. And then many of them have done quite well, so I'm feeling good about that. But yeah, it's just pure love. I just love the form. Yeah.
You are also, you mentioned that your training was a lot in acting, and you are also a director. Have you ever acted or directed one of your own plays, and would you ever?
So I was in a one-person show I wrote about James Baldwin called The Threshing Floor. So I was in that. That's the only time I've acted in something of mine. And then very recently, I teach at Villanova University. We produced a play of mine called White. And I did a pretty substantial rewrite of that play and then directed a production of it. I loved working with the students because I always love working with the students. I felt so close to that play. I was like, I shouldn't be directing this. It was way too close to me. So I don't think I'm going to do much of that. And I also just like love the collaborative relationship with the director. I love seeing how other people see the play. But who knows? I mean, yeah. I have a great admiration for playwrights who direct their own work a lot. I always feel like I'm in the way. Even when I'm when I was directing my own play, I was like, I'm in the way. And someone should come in here and fix this because I'm in the way.
Yeah. So Fat Ham is now running at the Public. What's next for you after that?
I have a show happening at Steppenwolf in the fall. It's called The Most Spectacularly Lamentable Trial of Miss Martha Washington, which is essentially very loosely based on the real history of Martha freeing the enslaved people on Mount Vernon because she was afraid they were going to kill her. That's actually what she thought and was written in letters. And I was like, that's wild. And that's a play. So I wrote a play sort of imagining what if she was right? And what does that mean? And that'll be directed by Whitney White. And so that's the next thing up. In the fall, you know, I'm teaching, which I love. Excited to do that. In the spring, back at the Public with Good Bones. Good Bones will also have another production very closely after that in DC at the Studio Theater. And then in Philly, the world premiere of another play of mine called Abandon, which will be at Theater Exile and directed by Brett Robinson.
And what's Good Bones about for people who don't know?
Good Bones is about Aisha, who is a very successful sort of urban planning thinking person. She works for cities to make them more livable. She moves back to her hometown, a town not unlike DC or Philadelphia or Detroit. And she moves into a home in a rapidly gentrifying area, her and her husband, both African-American. And they hire a contractor to come to work on their kitchen and remodel this kitchen that they want to be their dream kitchen. And what they discover over the course of the play is that the community is like desperately trying to hang on to who they used to be before the gentrification. And they sort of collide with that, Aisha and her husband. And so it's really a play about what is our responsibility to a community that we move into? How do we move into a community and become a part of the community and not try to like smother or kill or, you know, dissipate the people who have been there, who built it, who stayed? And it's also about the sort of ghost or the bones, really, of a place that you live. Like you're never are completely free of the history of everybody that's lived in a place. And I know that, you know, I bought a house in Philadelphia in a very rapidly gentrifying part of town. And, you know, I had to confront like, yeah, they, they pop firecrackers all summer. Like, that is going to be a thing from 10 o'clock at night till close to three. But then, like, the bad thing is to call the police on them, right? I don't do that. The good thing is to sort of create a culture where the kids know to not do that right underneath my bedroom window because they know me. And so it's really about an imagining of what happens if people decide to become a part of community as opposed to trying to change or disrupt or destroy a community.
And when will we see your version of Othello?
I'm getting close. It's I can tell you a bit about my take on it. It's essentially Iago. I probably shouldn't say this. Somebody might take, no, it's fine. It's an Othello character who's a computer scientist who's sort of grappling with racism inside of artificial intelligence. And the Iago character is an AI.
Cool.
And so it starts to mess with his own conception of like who he is and what he believes. And but I'm trying to work with an actual AI app to write parts of it. So that's the difficult part right now.
Yeah.
It's very early.
Well, we cannot wait to see that. And also Good Bones and everything else you've got coming up. Thanks so much for joining me, James. It was great to talk to you.
That was awesome. Thank you.
That was Pulitzer Prize winner James Imes, whose play Fat Ham is now running at the Public Theater through July 17th. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us grow our audience of folks who love theater as much as you and I do. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft, or give us a shout out on social media. Find past episodes and subscribe on all the pod places, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. Until next episode, find me on Twitter at @gcoxvariety. Thanks for listening, and see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.